And I would like to say welcome Mr. Anthony Figueroa to talking with the Art of Montague. It is a total pleasure.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
We're at the Sundance Film Festival, and you have a wonderful project that we want to talk to you about, but we want to get some information, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's just roll with the dice, okay? So how and why did you come to be an artist?
Well, how and why? You know, I grew up in the 80s, and I grew up in Spanish Harlem, New York. And at that time, you know, the 80s for me was a great era, just like the 60s were for the baby boomers. And a lot of transition with music, fashion, dancing, and so forth. I've always entertained my family and folks, and I love storytelling, and I love creating new things. So since I was a kid, I felt that, you know, I had that talent, that privilege to do that. And here I am, and give me a platform, and I'll take it all away.
Well, that's very interesting. But what was your inspiration? And I mean, you could have been many different things, but what was your inspiration to follow this path?
You know, I did, my inspiration was actually my surrounding, where I grew up. And, you know, a lot of times you're stuck up in this environment. People are born there, live there, and they die there. I used to be hooked on watching these old 50s to 70s shows, from The Honeymooners to The Odd Couple, and I've always seen the marquee of Hollywood, my little black and white TV. And I always told myself, one day I will be there. And I should have turned it off. And I told myself that one day I'm definitely going to get there.
Well,
so my inspiration was my surroundings, where I grew up. You're surrounded by entertainers. A lot of them don't know it. A lot of them don't make it out of there. And a lot of them, you know, go and conquer different...
where you were from, was there, like, places that you could go to get inspired or mentored in the arts? Because you have little places where there's basketball or other places.
Yes, I mean, yes and no. In my area, I did a lot of community theater, nothing major, no major productions yet. But again, I always liked to be part of production, and just, I was always curious of just, like I said, just trying to entertain and storytell, and I wanted to always be in front of the camera, always. Be in front of the camera. So.
You must have been a ham.
I was. I guess I was, yeah.
So, coming from there, from street art to, you know, music to dance, you know what the urban sound and art was. So, what's your definition of creativity coming from that?
My definition is a combination of everything. Like I said, I grew up in the 80s, so my thing back then was hip-hop. So I grew up in a hip-hop era, and it has come such a long way that I was just able to combine the hip-hop era to me growing up in the ghetto and in the hood, and then transitioning from there and coming out to Los Angeles to where I'm at today. It's what made me what I am today.
So, you know, I have to ask you, because I have spoken to a lot of artists, and a lot of artists have said, yes, their family has supported them, or they had to find support other places. Was your family supportive of you becoming an artist?
No, not at all, actually. You know, my family are very old school, and they believe in hard work. And if either you go to school or you work, so... either one or the other, and they were definitely not supportive of the arts whatsoever. So, and frankly, I really didn't need that support, because I was already determined and destined. I knew what was going to lie in front of me, what I was going to do, and I was going to do it regardless.
Well, as you know, we're here at the Sundance Film Festival, of course, mm-hmm. and the founder, he has admitted that in his youth he was a kind of prankster. He had a bit of a troubled youth. Were you one?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. Again, you know, in that environment, you tend to get into a lot of trouble. I wasn't a troublemaker per se, but the group that you hang around with, the friends you hang around with, you know, you are what your environment is. And yes, I definitely got into a lot of trouble. And back then, I was a big graffiti tagger, was my thing. So, I had a niche for tagging trains and tagging anything that had a white, clean wall on it or was repainted. I had to put a mark on it. Mm-hmm. And my signature had to be over. And there were many times where I got arrested and got in trouble. And my biggest fear is when I was younger, I remember getting in trouble. And the cop was walking me home, says, "I'm going to take you home." And I begged him to let me sit in jail for a night because I didn't want to face the wrath of my mom. Because I would have been worse than me sitting in juvenile hall.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have two questions. What was your tagger name?
Ace 173.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yes.
And next is, what was your family life like growing up? I mean, you just said you would rather sit in jail than face your mother.
Yes. You know, she, look. Like a lot of people, you know, I came from a pretty dysfunctional family, you know, broken home, father passed away, mom was an ex NYPD officer, and, you know, they put it like this, they did the best with the tools that they had.
Right.
That's all I can say. And I can't take anything away from them. It's just, they did the best they could.
Well, you had so much going on in your youth, and with the music, with the tagging, with the dance, everything. In what way did that influence you as you grew up, as the young kid? How did that influence you? Some people said it influenced them to become writers,
well,
get rap, whatever.
I was going to use that. That was a tool, the foundation for me to expand and to see where I can take it. At that time, I didn't know where I was going to go, but I knew I was going to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that entertaining and tagging and doing everything in the city in New York was great. It really was. But I always told myself, there's got to be something better than this and bigger than this. And how can I take it to that level? So I was a risk taker even back then, and I always wanted to go that extra mile. So if you were to tell me, don't cross that bridge, there may be danger, I want to know if, why, what, when, and where. And you know,
you were a risk taker.
I was. So.
But New York is a wonderful place for, let's say, those who are affluent. But those who are in the suburbs or minorities, it might not be the best, you know, place to take risks. So when you did get in trouble, what was the consequences of it when you really got in trouble?
You know, to answer that question, best would be my family, because they always told me I had an angel by my side. Because a lot of my friends didn't make it. I got friends that went to Rikers Island. Got friends that were doing 20 to life in prison, upstate New York, Elmira. I have friends that didn't even make it, that were shot and killed at a young age. So I was, you know, when I look back in my life, and I go back to neighborhood a lot, and I said, I take back and say, wow, I can't believe I made it. Because I was, there was so many situations where I should have been dead. Should have been dead. Or would have spent the rest of my life in jail.
Well,
so I must have had an angel looking over my shoulder.
I would say, you know, say so.
Yeah, because I made it out.
Well, can we kind of touch on what happened to you when you were younger, when, you know, you hit that wall and your angel kind of wasn't there?
So I'm not going to go into details,
okay.
But yeah, there was a moment in my life where I thought it was going to end. And again, I can go back and say I must have had an angel, because at that time and at that moment,
I really thought it was over. It was over for me. Going through what I've went through at that time. So
at that point, was there anyone you could turn to for help?
At that point, the only one you can count on is your friends. Because I was at a point in my life where you put your trust in these people, people with authority and power, and you think you're safe, but you're not. And I was put in a situation, a vulnerable situation, where I didn't think I was going to get out. And a few of us thought we were going to get out. And because you put all your trust and you kind of, you know, you take the walls down, that inner city walls down, you say, well, you know what, well, we're safe here. But actually, it was quite the opposite. And we ended up praying for one of the largest pedophile organizations in the country.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, that just takes my breath away. How in the world did you cross paths with the largest?
Well, to make a long story short, we got into trouble, and instead of spending the rest of the time in juvenile hall, which was Spofford at the time, I believe it was in Brooklyn, it was during the early 80s, they thought it would have been a great idea to put us into this organization. And this organization will take a bunch of inner city kids at that time and take them and teach them how to be good, decent, grown men, show them respect, and teach them all kinds of things that they don't learn when they're back at home. So we thought it was great, and it was excellent, and we were gung-ho about it, you know, because basically they take us out of our element,
right,
we're used to, bring us to a camp in upstate New York, in the beautiful wilderness and the forest and the green trees and the rivers and the creeks and the lakes, and it was just phenomenal. We thought we were in heaven, and little did we know it was quite opposite, that we actually fell prey to one of the largest pedophile rings that's been going on for over 100 years.
Wow.
And basically they prey on inner city kids like us in different cities and towns, and who nobody gives a shit about. You know, kids come from broken homes, and fathers in jail, mothers is dysfunctional, and so forth, and nobody gives a shit.
How was it that this organization was able to get away with this for so long?
That's a good question, because they've been doing it for 100 years, and it started back in the what they call the Baden-Powell days, is when he started the organization, Boys Town USA, and everybody thought he was a humanitarian, a leader, and providing great service to the community. We get these young boys, whether they're young boys or troubled boys, and this has been going on for centuries, for years. And basically, they prey on the weak. And these men, most of them, I'm not saying all of them, okay? Most of them were pedophiles with a disease and a sickness. And there are different types of pedophiles. And they're ones who watch, and they're ones who take joy into watching boys shower and do all these different disgusting things. And then there are some who actually violate them and sexually abuse them. So we fell in the hands of these demons, these so-called leaders that communities and political organizations look up to, and put them up on a pedestal, and they were nothing more than a bunch of sick, degenerate men, old men, who prey on weak inner-city kids for their enjoyment.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
I know this is a touchy subject for you, but can I ask, how long did she go through this? How long did she have to endure this?
It was a summer camp. So we went up for a summer camp, and again, it sure beats. At that time, it beat going and, you know, sitting behind bars. And it was supposed to be a summer camp, and then after that, they were supposed to report back with an evaluation to kind of see how we did, if we progressed, and then it ended up quite opposite, you know.
So how did you cope with what was being done to you?
Cope? Well, being as young as we were, I think we were around 10 under 12. After it was all said and done, you know, my friends and I, my good friends and I, at the time, we made a pact to never speak of it again. People ask me, how did you do it at that young age to have the know-how to cope with this type of trauma,
right,
and tragedy? And back then, it just, I don't know what it is, survival instincts kick in, right? Because you see a lot in the ghetto. People get shot, people get stabbed, so you sort of become desensitized to it and immune to it, to the point that, okay, we're never going to talk about this again, because it was humiliating.
Right.
Not to our parents, not to our other friends down the block, nobody. No one is to know. And well, I remember when we got back, it's sort of like everybody kind of went their different ways, and I sought out opportunity in Hollywood after that, moved out west, and kind of lost touch with everybody, and it was never brought up again.
Wow. So,
so to answer that question, coping with it, I put it in a place in the back of my mind where I call it the vault. And in that area, that's where the oil skeletons are. Everybody has it.
Right.
Some people utilize it, some people don't. Mm-hmm. And that is where I threw it in there, and I conveyed it into what I called a bad nightmare. That's all it was. And believing in that, that it was nothing but a bad nightmare, I was able to cope and live through life and be here today.
So, can I ask you, how is it, what do you think was the source or the reason? Basically, how did you survive when so many boys did not?
We survived because we were determined. Believe it or not, you take a bunch of inner city kids who's never been out to the woods. The toughest kids, you can take them out of the hood. Take them out of the ghetto. Whether you're in Compton, California, or you're in Southside Chicago, or you're in the Bronx, New York. You take them out of the hood and into this wildlife element, and they'll be shit scared. They hear, you know, bears walking around and footprints, and you're going to see them scream.
Yeah.
You know? And but one thing we do have is survival instincts. If you've got, when you're in the ghetto and you're brought up in the ghetto, you have to survive the streets every day.
Right.
So we're able to utilize our survival skills and to able to fight these predators to be able to come back, and I'm sitting here today telling you about it.
Right. So, so basically, you can take the boy out of the ghetto, but you can't
take the ghetto out of the boy. That's it.
Well, I'm glad that you're here sitting with me
now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
But I want to know, what was it like when you returned home? I mean, you put everything in the vault there, and your family hasn't changed, your home hasn't changed, but you've changed. What was that like?
You know, I can't sit here and I'd be lying to you if I told you that I went home and everything was great and we continued where we left off. Because, I look back at it now and I said, wow, I was pretty fucked up. And you can quote me on that. But I felt that I didn't want to burden my family with it.
Mm-hmm.
That it was something that I can handle and I'm okay. Because I'm strong and I can move on. And I was able to, like I said, I threw it in the back of the vault, and I was able to use my imagination, which is the entertainment side, and that occupied 99% of my brain because I was so busy, and all I wanted to do, I was driven and determined to entertain and perform and doing plays, whether it is plays or dancing or whatever it is. And that's what my focus was primarily.
Literally, like a lot of tortured artists say, are their art saved their life?
Absolutely. Now, I can't speak for my friends. I haven't seen or heard from them. And when this movie comes out, they're probably going to be really pissed off.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I'm not going to ask your age or anything, but over the years, sometimes cracks happen in that vault, and sometimes things leak out. Was there a time anywhere that you something told you, I have to tell someone? Did you tell anyone?
It wasn't till my second child. I was at a school function. I was already married. I'd been married. My wife didn't even know. Mm-hmm. But I had been married, and my wife was interested in enrolling my son into the Scouts. Well, she hinted. Mm-hmm. That would have been a good idea. You did it, Tony. She knew I did it, but she didn't know the details. And that's when that's when it came out. And I said, there's no way I'm going to ever put my son in the Scouts. And you know what? It's sad because not all Scoutmasters are bad.
Right.
You know, not all. And even when I was pitching the idea, a lot of them told me they had the best experience in the world with the Boy Scouts. And that's fantastic. But I didn't. And there are many victims across the country, and the thousands that did it.
Right.
So at that time, it just seems like for some reason that year, it all came to play. The Catholic Church was on the news every day. And the priests were being accused of having sex with their altar boys. And all of a sudden, a lot of celebrities were coming out and talking about sexual abuse. And I said, you know what? My kids are wondering why I wouldn't put them in the Boy Scouts. And I just kept lying and lying and lying why I don't think it's a good idea. And I thought it was that time I said, it's time to tell the story. This was in the mid-90s.
Wow.
Yeah, in the mid-90s where all of a sudden the vault kind of opened up, because it's just been locked up.
Right.
I've already been married. I've established a family. I'm busy. I don't have time to think about that. And But it just seemed like for some reason it opened. And I said, shit, maybe this is it. And I told my wife about it at that time. And she said, well, you're in a position where others don't have a voice. You have a great platform, a good forum to talk about it. And hopefully they will hear your story. So that's when I started.
Well, I think we touched on it, but how did this shape your life? I mean, some people go into a tailspin and never come out. Some people have to go into a mental hospital. Some people are aggressive post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
They deal with other people. They just close off. How did this shape your life?
Look, if I sit here and tell you that everything was fine and hunky-dory, I'd be lying. Could I have used therapy? Absolutely. Could I have used counseling? Absolutely I could have. Because I look back now and I said, well, you know, I've made some very poor decisions, some bad choices, and maybe it would have helped me make better choices, make better decisions in life, in my personal life, in my professional career, with my family and children and so forth. So, but overall, I had to, I'll give you an example. I was born pigeon-toed. I was too poor to get it fixed by a doctor, by an orthopedic doctor, to put braces on and to straighten out my foot in time. So at a young age, I had to tell myself and train myself mentally. When I caught myself walking with both feet inside, I put my feet outside so I would walk like a duck. I did that for 3 years, and I solved the problem.
Wow.
So that, I did the same thing with that. I kept saying, if that nightmare comes out, it's going to ruin me, and I don't want to be ruined. I'm in a good place in my life. I got a great family. I'm doing well, and that's not going to come out. So I made sure I kept it in the vault.
If that answers your question, does that make sense?
That makes sense, but that has to take a whole lot of strength and fortitude and perseverance for you, just like you said with the being pigeon-toed and you training yourself to walk right, you to use that same element for this. That's beyond.
Well, because, you know, when you grow up with nothing, you become very resourceful and innovative. You start creating stuff. Just like, you know, you ever see a guy do 20 years in prison and he makes all these kind of different stuff that you've never seen in any place else, but they can create it because they have so much time.
Right.
And since you can't buy it and you can't afford it, I said, maybe I can build it. And I had no choice if I wanted to be alive and be a decent man and a model citizen of society. I had no choice but to keep this in the back. I had no choice but not to bring this to the forefront so that my family and my wife would see or question what's wrong.
Right.
So that's what I had to do.
So could we say that you kind of had to wear a mask?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I look back at it now. I definitely wore many masks, you know, because in your professional career, you put on a smile and you so that way you can fit in. In my thing, I had to wear the mask so I could fit in because I didn't want anybody to question about my past.
So, what is your life like to today? I mean,
fantastic.
Man, you just said you have a wife, children, successful.
It's fantastic. My, you know, the last 20 years have been great. And in any business, it's always ups and downs. And overall, I've been blessed. It's been great. I had the opportunity to rub shoulders and work with the finest people in Hollywood, the elite of Hollywood. I learned a lot. I've been mentored by the best. And you know what? I look back and coming from where I came from, and sitting here with you now, I look back and I said, man, it was a great ride.
It certainly
is. It was a great ride. And so maybe whatever happened to me back then in New York had to take place in order for me to be here today to enjoy the ride for the last 20 years.
I think that's very true. But what's the driving force? So what was the early years as an emerging artist, and what was your aha moment that you realized that you made the right decision, this is what you wanted to do?
Well, I knew I wanted to be in Hollywood, that's for sure. In one way or another, I was going to get there. So I was doing plays in community theater in New York, and I came to Los Angeles to become an actor. I wanted to do film and television. So I auditioned. I landed an agent and was going to tons of auditions, good auditions, and didn't land anything. And at one time, a casting director told me I was awful.
Oh, my goodness.
And I appreciated that. I really did. But I was determined, after going out to so many auditions, not landing any roles, I said, how am I going to get into the business? I'm not going back to New York, bro. I refuse to go back to New York, bro. So I said, one way or another, I'm going to get in. If it's not through the front door, through the back door, but I'm going to get in. So I tried a different avenue, and I started to work on the production side. I said, okay, if I can't get in front of the camera as an actor, I'm going to get behind it. And eventually, I'll make a full 3 and come around, and I'll be in the front of the camera. So I got a job as a PA on the show, on a pilot, that Warner Brothers was producing, and so I got I was a PA on the pilot. I did the pilot in Los Angeles, went back to New York, got a call 2 months later from Warner Brothers saying that the show got picked up for 24 episodes, and fly back, I was promoted. To make a long story short, I was on the show for, I believe, 8 seasons, and winning Emmy Award for Best Drama, second season. It was one of the highest rated shows, over 50 million viewers, I believe, at one time. And got to work with some tremendous artists, tremendous people. And that right there was my aha moment, because when I finally begged the executive producer to give me a part, a small part, a five line or whatever it is, I was able to acquire my SAG card at that time. And once I left that set as an actor, and finally getting my SAG card, I told myself, I was outside by myself, and I told myself, you see, I told you I was going to get it.
Congratulations.
You know, it took a couple of years, but I told you I was going to get it, and I was very proud.
Well, you, whether it's writing, painting, filmmaking, you are an artist at your heart. So what is the artistic meaning or statement to your work?
You know, when working on the production side, I learned all the logistics and the development, the tools that it takes to create film or television, right? To create the product, to get your product off, which is amazing, the process. And working as an actor, I learned to respect the craft and what it is, what it takes to deliver from the product that they're giving you, that they created. During that time, through all those years, I learned one thing, is that I like original and original content, meaning whatever it is, whether it's film or it's a new invention, it has to be new, never told, never seen. And my thing was original stories, to be able to develop, not really to develop, to be able to take original stories and transform them into film, in television, and to be able to tell the story and have an audience. That's probably my art, what I've taken in the past and what I've lived through, and all the 80s era, I was able to take that and incorporate it into my work.
Right. Well, if we circle back to the monumental task of an artist to create change, what impact do you want your work to have and why?
Well, on this piece, and on my honor, I want to be able to create awareness overall. To, after I'm dead and gone, I want to be able to, my kids and my grandkids and so forth, to be able to say, Anthony Figueroa, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, whatever the case, has started that movement and made that change. And I, you know, I always told, after 30, I never thought I would make it to 30, for then 40 come along. And I said, okay, well, it looks like I'm going to be here for a while. So I'm going to contribute, make sure I make a fine contribution, because when I die, I just don't want to be like everybody else. And I want people to say good things about me. I want people to say that Anthony Figueroa definitely contributed to society, that helped others, whether it's through work, I created employment, whatever, or I helped somebody from preventing suicide, or I was the voice. And whatever the case may be, I want to be known as I did something good. And I made a good contribution to the side before I left. And in my work, that's what I want to leave behind, and that's what I want people to know me for. Look, this film here, I do it if it's free. There's no money you can put on this film. I can't be bought. And this is a story that needs to get out. And I will in no way, shape, or form compromise my work. And there's no amount of money in the world that you can pay me to not pursue this. So,
well, that being said, what have been the obstacles you've had to overcome with this project?
The obstacles is, you know, at that time I felt, well, here I am. I got a deal. I'm working at the studio. I'm working with the best of the best. Let them read my material. Let's get this off the ground. And I gave it to a couple executives there. And I remember telling Michael Crichton, before he passed away, God rest his soul, but I give him a brief description about what I was writing, and he was perturbed by it and didn't really care for it.
Really?
Didn't care for it whatsoever. So, and as others were reading it, the feedback was that change the organization. nobody wants to touch it, you know, during that time. And this is all before, you know, the Catholic churches and the priests were, before they were even all over the news. Nobody wanted to touch this powerful organization. They thought it was too risky. Nobody wanted to take that risk. So what I thought I was, this was going to be easy to deliver became very hard in the business I was in. So it wasn't until a couple years ago when I came to volunteer for Sundance, when Sundance opened my eyes, and I said, you know what? The only way this film is going to get made, if I do it myself. So after a couple years of research and workshops and learning and working with others to try now to help get this film off the ground, that's why we're here.
Well, what are the steps that you have been taking to bring this project to life?
We have, we are in the, I would say, the primary stages right now of acquiring funds, working with venture capitalist investors, angel investors, into acquiring funds for the film. And I'm working with some good producers right now into actually getting this off the ground.
Did you have any obstacles to overcome, such as learning difficulties, health issues, disabilities, education, or dependencies?
Not to an extreme. I mean, I can't say this didn't change my way of thinking. Yes, absolutely, because it put me in a place where, for example, like I told you before, anytime I see a scout uniform or any kind of reference to the Boy Scouts of America, it comes out of the vault. Mm-hmm. And the images come out, and I become aggressive, and you know, my whole character changes as far as the way I feel at that moment of time when I'm experiencing it. So, yes, that definitely had some impact to how I felt and how I could deal with things and the choices that I made in life.
Well, so you've never had therapy, even to
I've
this
never,
day?
I've never had therapy, even to this day.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And you know what? When I say I never had therapy, I think when I look back, I said, well, there's a reason why things happen. Maybe Hollywood was my therapy. As funny as it may sound, you know, before this all happened, even as a child, I knew I wanted to go to Hollywood. And then I went through all the trials and tribulations and going with it. I went with the organization and the sexual abuse, and here I am today, and maybe that was my therapy.
Well,
I was never addicted to drugs. Did I do them? Yes, I dabbled, but I never got to the point where I needed rehab, and I always knew, you know, it was funny. People, maybe I was a weird or different kind of kid. Even back then, I always knew when to stop. Because I didn't like the feeling. So if any kind of drug that I was doing, if it took me to a point where I'm unable to think quickly or on my feet, in case of an emergency, I didn't like it. I don't like that feeling when you take me out of that.
The feeling of helplessness.
Right. That I'm not able to think or make a quick decision if I need to. So that's why, you know, I was fortunate that I was never addicted and never needed it. Always had it. I just never needed it. And I knew in my mind, and even as a family member, I mean, as a husband and a father, I had a lot of friends who were addicted to drugs, a lot of friends that were addicted to meth, and they lost their homes, their jobs, their wives, their kids. I mean, they went through the ringer. And the biggest fear for me was I told myself I would never get to that point. I will never choose a drug over my life or family. If I was out socializing with some friends and, you know, we did a little bit here or there for a party, that's fine, but that's probably as far as I would go.
No, you are an extraordinary example of what a person can do when they are determined and have hope and faith on their side. And I think we've delved into the deep, darkest side
right.
of life. I think we've kind of lightened the mood
Absolutely.
A bit.
Absolutely.
So if...
Please.
If you could invite six people, living or dead, mind you, to dinner, who... And I know you have to be a fantastic cook. Someone in your house has to be a fantastic cook. who would they be and why?
Well, this answer is going to throw you off because it would have nothing to do with cooking and it wouldn't be positive. If I had the opportunity to invite six people dead or alive to table, one of them will be my father, and the other five will be all the scoutmasters sexually abused. So, how's that for lighting? How's that for lighting? Yeah.
Yeah, that would be a massacre right there. I don't even have to.
Right.
Your father and them? Oh,
right.
No.
So, that's who I would definitely invite to the table.
There goes. Goose is the ones that would be cooked.
That's right.
Okay, is this something you would do even if you never got paid? You know, if you never got paid as being an actor, screenwriter, production, working in production, would you still do it if they said, you're great at it, but guess what? No money. Would you still do it?
Absolutely. There's no price on this. There's, you know, unfortunately, look, in this business, it takes money to make money. I can't shoot this film for free. So we have to acquire funds in order to get this film off the ground. But if that meant not taking a salary or being paid for it, absolutely. I don't need any type of compensation for this at all, whatsoever. And I'm going to say that again. I don't need any compensation whatsoever. I'll shoot this movie for a whole year straight for free, if that's what it takes, to know that the end results would be that people are going to see it, and I was able to be a voice and a representative for those who didn't have the opportunity or don't have the opportunity or don't want the opportunity to talk about it. Because I feel that once this is done, that there'll be men and women, you know, that can talk about their sexual abusive experience and what they encounter, because you have to talk about it. You know, I think if I talked about it at an early age, I probably would have made better choices and better decisions in life. But I didn't, and that's okay. I can't rewind time. We just move forward. But I hope that with me doing this project, I like I said, it's bigger than money. Money has no debt, and cannot. I won't compromise this film whatsoever for money.
Well, it sounds like this film will finally give you the closure.
Not just for me, but for everyone, and for my kids, because they'll understand, and I feel that they'll be able to, like I said, raise this awareness, open their eyes, even for those that are not victims and have no idea or never knew that this took place, but it would open their eyes and to protect their children. Many parents do not protect their children. I'm not just talking about from the Boy Scouts or from the churches. I'm talking about from your priest, your uncle, the people that come into your lives across that threshold. Your home is supposed to be the safe haven. Wow. And many people, many parents, they are blind by that. And they trust everyone. And trust is earned. And you can't trust everyone.
That's very true.
Okay,
I'm going to give you a few questions and words, and I just want you to say the first thing that comes to your mind.
Oh, okay.
Family.
Love.
Art.
Passion.
Living.
Well.
Determination.
Driven.
Faith.
God.
Wonderful. Okay, so where do you see yourself in 5, 10, or 20 years?
Well, I never looked that far ahead, but if I'm alive, I see myself as a filmmaker and being able to open the doors for others to help others display their stories the way I did. And to provide a tool for others to make a path for them, for the business, because it's very tough. The business is very tough, and a lot of people get discouraged very quickly, and you cannot. And if it's your passion and you have that goal, the whole purpose of it is to continue that goal to death. You tell yourself, I'm doing it to death.
Right.
So you're going to do whatever it takes to get to that point of your life.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that I'm able to provide and open the door for others in whichever entity I'm in, whatever I can do, whether it's film or counseling or whatever it is. I just hope that I create maybe some kind of movement, you know, and then maybe start a foundation where others can come out and talk about it and feel safe and feel good about it and know that there's others just like them. You know, so we're all one big fam.
That's fantastic. So what advice would you have for up-and-coming artists?
Up-and-coming artists in general?
Well, you know, artists that are starting out and trying to,
you know,
break in.
Like I said, this is a tough business. If you have the passion for it, wonderful. This is your passion. If entertaining and telling stories, and if you have a gift, you have the talent to do that, do it for the right reasons. Don't do it for the money. The problem is with up-and-coming artists today is they all want to get rich quick, and they're not doing it for the right reasons. And if you go back, just study the history and look back at the Desi Arnaz days, Lucy, I Love Lucy, and the all the films that were shot in the 20s and 30s, these people shot on seriously low budgets, hardly no money films, and they did it for passion. Alfred Hitchcock. I can name quite a few filmmakers that money wasn't the issue. You did it because you were passionate about it. And you're able, with that passion, you're able to give that, you know, others, well, by either way of making them laugh or making them cry. So I tell them, you know, do it for the right reasons. And if you're an up-and-coming artist, great. Don't do it for money.
Well, I know quite a few from what I'd like to know. So who's your favorite filmmaker who inspired you? You mentioned Alfred Hitchcock. So who's your favorite filmmaker?
There's actually quite a few. But one of my favorites is Martin Scorsese. He's one of my favorite filmmakers.
Wow.
Alfred Hitchcock was definitely one of my favorites. I love that genre. So,
to close, what does art is life and life is art mean to you?
Well, what it means to me is able to collaborate the two, my personal life and my professional life. So when you collaborate the two, you're able to balance. And I'm able to balance my art life with my personal life as far as my craft. I'm able to incorporate certain things out of my personal life into my career life and vice versa. And that, if you're able to balance that, then I think you'd do well. Then you can call yourself an artist.
Well, Mr. Figueroa, thank you so very much. You have given us... It's been extraordinary to spend time with you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor.